This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. We've all heard of it. We all chase it to one degree or another. But whether we get it is often out of our control. The American dream and how you get from here to there on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. From the studios of KQED in San Francisco, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 16th of April today. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. You remember the big General Motors ignition switch scandal of a year or so ago? You remember the 84 or maybe 85 deaths tied to that defect? And you remember the tens of billions of dollars in liability the experts figured GM was going to face as a result? Okay, now forget all that. A bankruptcy court judge has ruled General Motors is protected from liability in most suits arising from the defective switches that were installed before the company's bankruptcy in 2009. It is, yes, a very nice legal win for GM, but it is not the company's last legal challenge, as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
The judge ruled that the liability shield included in the 2009 bankruptcy agreement should be allowed to remain in place for cars sold before 2009. John Patow is a professor of law at the University of Michigan. He says the ruling is great for GM.
Yeah, it's a big deal because what they wanted to do is try to bulletproof their bankruptcy reorganization plan.
Patow says the ruling establishes a legal separation between the old GM and the new post-bankruptcy company. Still, the legal aspect is far from resolved. Patow says the fact that the new GM knew about the defective switches but did not bring up the issue during bankruptcy could help the plaintiffs.
The law takes notice incredibly seriously, and if someone figures out they do something wrong, they have to send out notice right away, particularly if they want to, if they've discharged something in bankruptcy. So that could be another hook they're trying to grab onto to say we still have a second bite at the apple.
Steve Berman is co-counsel in the suit against GM. He says they will be appealing the ruling. Even factoring out the cars that are shielded from liability, GM could still be on the hook for economic losses for people who bought cars after the bankruptcy.
Conservatively, there's still 10 million cars left, and the average value of diminution was 700. That's $7 billion.
In addition to suits for economic losses, the company still faces lawsuits for people who were injured in crashes. In a statement, GM applauded the judge's decision and stated that any claims not barred by the ruling must still be proven in court. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
If you have a child in school, or honestly, even if you don't, you probably know education is smack in the middle of a big digital overhaul. Tablets and laptops and homework apps, everything. If you follow education news out of Los Angeles, you probably also know the overhaul here isn't going so well. The latest snafu in the Los Angeles Unified School District's billion-dollar tech mess. It's an iPad for every student, teacher, and administrator in the district plan that collapsed amid charges of backroom deals and shady negotiations. Now has the LAUSD, the LA Unified School District, asking Apple to give them back millions of dollars. Marketplace's Nova Sappho reports that when it comes to education and high tech, schools are getting a tough lesson in being overmatched.
It was so much easier when schools were just buying textbooks and pencils.
Historically, the classroom looked, you know, what it looked like for 100 years.
That's changing fast, says Michael Moe, CEO of GSV Capital, a venture capital fund.
Today, you know, increasingly, you know, every teacher has a smartphone. Most of the kids do, too. Mainly, every school in America is connected.
Mo's firm runs a summit for EdTech startups. He says 5 years ago, they had 30 participants. This year, there were nearly 300. And it's not just startups clamoring to get into the digital classroom. Google, Microsoft, and Apple are all trying to grab a share of the $13 billion EdTech market. Say nothing of the big educational publishers like Houghton Mifflin and Pearson. Its software is in the iPads that LA Unified wants to return. Stephen Baker is with the NDP Group, a market research firm.
What we've definitely seen, and certainly in the last 2 to 3 years, is a real explosion of personal devices available for students in big educational institutions.
But, says education consultant Allison Bailey, the changes have come so fast that school districts can't keep up with them.
Because of the flood of offerings that are emerging in the market, it's a lot for school districts to actually think through and manage on their own.
Bailey says part of the problem is that the new technology is new and there's limited data about how well it works. So she says that makes it even harder for school districts to make educated decisions. I'm Nuvasafa for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a slow morning, a big pop after lunch, and then a long, slow fade to break even at the close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You can go ahead and say this for Hillary Clinton. She is not wasting any time, the time she spent saying she hadn't made up her mind about whether she was going to run or not. With a 2-day swing through Iowa in the rearview mirror today, Clinton's campaign said she is going to do basically the same thing next week in New Hampshire. Small meetings, the personal touch, direct candidate on voter contact, retail politicking, I think they call it, which is actually, now that I think about it, quite the apt phrasing, because what the former First Lady and Senator and Secretary of State has to do over the next 18 months or so is at least as much a rebranding campaign as it is a run for office. So Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson went out and talked to some rebranding professionals.
Getting voters or consumers to take a second look at a candidate, a company, a product, something they already think they know, that's tough work, says Scott Davis with Profit, a brand strategy firm.
The overall goal is to force reconsideration.
And Clinton's campaign knows this.
One of the most important things in this campaign process is that there's a lot that people think they know about Hillary Clinton and a lot they really don't know about Hillary Clinton.
Which is why Karen Finney with the Clinton campaign says they're starting small and slow, one-on-one conversations. Davis, the brand guy, says, yeah, it's important that Clinton be authentic and very clear about her purpose, that she give people the tools to advocate on her behalf. But instead of starting small, she might need to go big.
What I would call a series of bold moves or innovations that shake loose preconceived notions that they may have of your brand.
Take one of Davis's clients, T-Mobile. He says a few years ago, it tried to catch consumers' attention by offering no-contract plans in the contract-heavy cell industry. Or more recently, Buick's campaign to get consumers to reconsider cars they might have written off as too stodgy.
Well, Valerie said she's driving a Buick.
She doesn't look like a Buick.
Take a fresh look at Buick. It just might surprise you.
Now, Buick was your father's car.
Howard Belk, co-CEO and chief creative officer at Siegel & Gale, says Clinton's no Buick. She doesn't need something quite so dramatic. Instead, her relaunch might reference something about her history in a way that won't alienate her supporters, but with fresh ideas and programs.
And they know change is required because, after all, she lost last time.
Belk says after her supporters, the second group Clinton should be targeting is the switchers. In brand terms, the people who may be open to a product even if they don't currently use it.
The switchers are suspicious. They're suspicious of the whole category. And she's got some baggage from some of the prior brand missteps, including very recent ones like the email scandal.
Belk says the third category is the detractors. He says don't bother trying to pander to the detractors. They're a lost cause. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Hillary Clinton is far from the first, nor dare I say will she be the last presidential candidate to rebrand themselves. See how it's been done in the past, successfully and not so much, at marketplace.org. The ad world spends a whole lot of money trying to make you feel something. Trying to make you laugh, make you cry sometimes, make you hungry even, just so you will buy stuff. But as the old saying about advertising goes, half the money spent on it is wasted. They just don't know which half. Well, there's a company called Affectiva that says it can help. They do emotional data mining. And when I was in New York last week, I met up with co-founder Rana El-Kayoubi. First thing she did when we sat down in the studio was pull out an iPad.
All right. So here we go. I got an iPad in front of me, and it's, wow, my face is on that iPad, and it's doing some, clearly some, like, sensor mapping, right? It's got, like, dots all over my face, and there's a grid line. And
so it's basically locked onto your face, and then it's detecting the motion of your facial features, like your eyes, your eyebrows, your mouth.
Yeah, so this is so interesting. When I smile, it says I'm smiling, and when I'm raising my brow, it says I'm raising my brow. All right.
Exactly. So it's recognizing the different facial expressions you're making. So let's test it. I try smiling. There it is.
Yeah. So I get a 45% on my smile.
Then she watched me watch something.
All right. So we're just doing the iPad thing here, right? All right. It's gotten my face. All right. I'm touching the screen. There we go. All right. It's a Doritos ad.
Billy, use the cleaners.
No. That's weird.
Touchdown.
Yeah, it only works with Doritos.
Why only Doritos?
You ask too many questions, Billy.
This is a weird ad. The guy stuck his finger in a hole. It got cleaned off. Oh, no. That's disgusting. Oh, man. Because there's a guy on the other side of the wall sucking his fingers off because with the Doritos stuff. Oh, man.
Then she showed me what the iPad saw.
The blue thing is you.
Yeah.
And it's showing you your valence, so how positive or negative your experience is.
So above the line is positive, below the line
is negative. Correct.
So I started negative because I was like, what the heck is this?
Right.
And then I got positive for some reason. And then, wow, I got really negative.
So, of course, I had a couple of questions.
Right.
So this is all really interesting and I imagine useful, but I need you to explain to me how one might use this.
Sure. So emotions influence every aspect of our life.
Okay.
From how we connect and communicate with each other and also how we make decisions.
Okay.
We feel that our emotions are missing from the digital world and our digital experiences. And at Affectiva, our vision is to bring that emotion into the equation.
And this is, in theory, not conscious behavior, right? I mean, I can do a, oh, look at that and be surprised.
Right.
But in real life, actually, if you're watching a piece of content, whether it's a political ad or whatever, it's a genuine thing.
Exactly. It's very spontaneous.
Right. Is it also a little creepy?
There are definitely applications that you know, blur the line. And as a company, we've stayed away from those types of applications. We're more focused on the ones where we feel we can bridge a communication gap.
Well, yeah, but there's going to be a business opportunity that's going to come up where you're going to say, well, let's see, this is $11 gajillion and we need some money and maybe we could let them use that.
So far, we have stayed away from those.
Yeah,
because our value system as a company is to engage in applications where there's clear opt-in, where people have consented to be recorded.
Run me through the list of companies that might use this, right? Because there have been car companies that use it. I mean, all kinds of things.
So the first kind of class of companies that use our technology are the advertisers. And so far, we've collected over 2.7 million face videos in 75 countries of people responding to content. Mm-hmm. And there, the problem we're solving is how emotionally engaged are you with a product or a service or an ad? So that's one class of applications. The other one is around video communication. So real-time video chats where, you know, there's multiple people in a conversation, and it's really hard to capture the emotions.
We've all been in those video conferences, right?
Right.
But I have to tell you, I'm not sure I want to be in a video conference where somebody can look at me on their screen and say, oh, yeah, Kai thinks that I am full of baloney or whatever, right? Because my face kind of gives me away.
Well, there are some applications where it's trickier to imagine it, like meetings. But imagine, like, an online education use case or a webinar where you're presenting and you have no idea if your audience are engaged with what you're saying or not. Like you say a joke and you have no idea if it's funny or not.
Are you a behavioral scientist or a computer scientist? Where did you come from to get to this point where you're doing this stuff?
My background is computer science and I spent many, many hours with my computer and it just really bugged me that it was very oblivious to my emotional state, and that kind of inspired and motivated me to build a emotionally intelligent computer.
So that's a loaded emotionally intelligent computer, right? Because, I mean, well,
that's anyway. A long way to go.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Good. Well, I feel better now. Rana, thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you.
We've got a video of this whole thing. It's kind of worth checking out. It's on our website, marketplace.org. Coming up.
You look at the number of bowling alleys, you actually see quite a positive relationship between the fraction of kids that are rising up out of poverty.
Bowling and the American dream straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Things were almost unchanged on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrial slipped 6 points, less than a 10%, finished at 18,105. The NASDAQ down 3 points, also less than a 10%, 5,007, 5,007 there. The S&P 500 lost a single point again, less than a 10%, closed at 2104. Stock markets, as you know, are a bet on the future, and Netflix quarterly report shows why. Many more new subscribers than expected, good for the future. Much higher programming costs, bad today. Both can, of course, be true, but the optimists won today. Netflix up 18%. Philip Morris International suffered from a strong dollar as tobacco sales overseas brought in fewer of those dollars. But Philip Morris beat earnings estimates and lit up 8.7%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. Are consumers experiencing inflation in their day-to-day living expenses? The Labor Department releases a consumer price index for March. The Conference Board issues its monthly index of leading economic indicators for March. And music lovers convene in Indio, California for the second weekend of Coachella. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. You can't cover the American economy without, in one way or another, having in the back of your mind the American dream. Whether it's rags to riches or just doing better than your parents did, upward mobility is part of the economic DNA in this country, even as it's debatable right now how real, how achievable the American dream actually is. Economists at Harvard and Berkeley have been trying to figure that out. And it turns out the answer varies widely depending on where you're from. Their theory, the economists at Harvard and Berkeley, is that by looking at places that have really bad rates of upward mobility, what things those places have in common and what they are missing in their fabric, maybe we can learn a thing or two. And that is what sent Chrissy Clark from our Wealth and Poverty Desk on a trip out to Dayton, Ohio.
In Dayton, 40% of children born poor stay poor, and just 5% make it into the top fifth of earners by the time they're adults. I'll get to some of the things that may drive those statistics in a moment. But first, it's worth pointing out that Dayton used to have a very different reputation. For most of the early 20th century, Dayton was known for innovation, opportunity, and upward mobility, full of people from humble backgrounds who made it. Like, say, the Wright brothers, who invented the airplane, or their high school classmate, Paul Lawrence Dunbar.
I know what the caged bird feels, alas.
Dunbar was born in Dayton in 1872 to parents who'd been born into slavery.
I know why the caged bird beats his wing till its
This
blood
is a
is
reading of one of his poems called Sympathy.
For he must fly back to his perch and cling.
When he wrote it, he was just out of high school, too poor to afford college, and working as an elevator operator. To support his poetry, he sold copies of his poems for a dollar to people who rode on his elevator. But just a decade later, he had catapulted himself into a different life.
He was the first African-American poet to become internationally famous. He met with the Queen of England. He met with Teddy Roosevelt.
Alex Heckman with the Dayton History Museum says Dunbar was a major inspiration for poets throughout the 20th century, like Maya Angelou. Maybe you recognize echoes of Dunbar's voice in her poem, Caged Bird. And here in Dayton, Dunbar could turn all that literary success into economic success, too, as Heckman showed me.
We're looking at the Italianate-style two-story brick home of Paul Lawrence Dunbar. He really wanted to purchase the finest home that he could afford. It was a lovely middle-class neighborhood when he was living here.
Paul Lawrence Dunbar's house is now a historic landmark on what's now called Paul Lawrence Dunbar Street. Alex Heckman's organization gives tours of the home to the public, but the neighborhood around the house has changed a lot since Dunbar's time. What was once a lovely middle-class neighborhood is now a place Alex worries about bringing visitors. A warning, the next few seconds get a little graphic.
We've had violent felonies take place either on or immediately adjacent to the house itself. There was a homicide victim. Body was dumped and set on fire literally feet from the visitor center entrance.
A few doors down, a young man was shot.
We heard two rounds fired and then three more rounds shortly thereafter. The last, you know, half century of disinvestment in neighborhoods like this one is tragic.
So how does a place that celebrates a man who so famously achieved the proverbial American dream become a place so full of nightmares? That is, of course, not something a few minutes of radio can even begin to fully answer. But the fact that this neighborhood and many others like it in cities across the country have become so disinvested, so economically isolated, so full of concentrated poverty and the problems that come with it, that fact in itself has become a key part of Harvard economist Nathan Hendren's research on upward mobility.
Areas where there's more concentrated poverty, more economic segregation, tend to have lower rates of upward mobility.
Nathan Hendren's team has combed through decades of IRS data to track the earnings of kids born into poor families once they reach adulthood. They wanted to know which places have the best rates of upward mobility, which have the worst, and why. They've looked at all kinds of possible factors.
Like the quality of the labor market.
And.
Tax policies.
And.
Mean incomes in the areas, income growth, measures of immigration, the number of bowling alleys per capita.
What did you just say?
Yeah. So if you look at the number of bowling alleys, you actually see quite a positive relationship between the fraction of kids that are rising up out of poverty.
The theory there being that bowling alleys might be a sign of broader community engagement. But among all these different factors Nathan and his research team looked at, a few patterns rose to the top. One of the clearest in cities and towns across the country was that areas with lots of economic segregation and concentrated poverty do much worse when it comes to mobility.
The extent to which the poor at the bottom of the income distribution are geographically segregated from the middle class and the upper class. So it's really about, are people from disadvantaged backgrounds economically integrated into the local area?
In other words, a crucial part of economic mobility seems to be whether rich and poor and middle class people are bumping into each other and interacting on a daily basis. The answer to that question in Dayton over the past couple decades has been a distinct...
No, not at all.
Kathleen Somerset Fields grew up in a public housing project not far from Paul Lawrence Dunbar's home, long after he died, once it was in a neighborhood known for concentrated poverty and extreme racial segregation. The area's known as Dayton's West Side. Kathleen says stereotypes about West Dayton are so ingrained that in job interviews, she tries to avoid saying that's where she grew up.
You know, when you put that down on your resume and stuff, it's like, oh, the West Side of Dayton, here we go. I don't want to be looked at like that. I'm not the West.
But there's stereotypes that still come to mind that people have.
Yes.
Yeah.
Growing up, Kathleen faced an overwhelming tangle of struggles. Her mom and stepdad battled with drug addiction. Kathleen and her siblings were moved into foster care for a time. At 13, she had her first child and was basically the mother to her six younger siblings, paying bills, managing the food stamps and government assistance they survived on.
It was hard, but I'm grateful for it.
Why?
Because... Sorry. I don't know, I would say it empowered me. It really did, and stuff, to strive for better, to want better, to do better.
And she did. Somehow, unlike most of the kids she grew up with, Kathleen beat those overwhelming odds working against those born into poor families in Dayton and places like it. Today, she is the assistant manager of a youth program at a community center. She says she's definitely not rich, but...
I consider myself surviving. Is that a category?
I think
can we make that one?
I think we can make it one.
Surviving on the good end.
Of course, it's impossible to say exactly why Kathleen found a way to climb out of poverty when so many of her peers have not. When I asked her what she thinks, she immediately pointed to one thing, actually to one person.
My boss now, Diane Brogan Adams, she was my teacher back then.
Her teacher in a GED class she took when she was 16.
And every time I would fall off, for some reason that lady always came and got me. Like, she would wonder, where am I at? Kathleen, hey, we haven't seen you for a while. You know, let's go ahead and get you through this class. You're almost there. And I graduated.
More on how crucial that education and those sorts of relationships can be, and why researchers think they might be key ingredients for economic mobility tomorrow. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which I suppose you could file under practicing what you preach. Etsy, the crafty sales, retail, homemade items site, started trading this morning. Did real well, too. Shares popped about 88%, 30-something dollars a piece at the close. More to the point, though, Etsy CEO Chad Dickerson, who we had on this program about a year, maybe a year and a half ago, told Business Insider that everything he was wearing to celebrate the IPO, all of his clothes, were bought on the site, right down to his socks. We're going to put that interview up on our homepage so you can hear what he told me is his favorite thing that he bought on that site ever. And it's not socks, I'll tell you that. All right, we got to go. That's all we got. Might as well have taken the day off on Wall Street today. The Dow off 6 points. That's less than a 10%. The NASDAQ dropped 3 points, also less than a 10%. The S&P 500 down 1 point, completing the trifecta there, less than a 10%. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.